Okay, so in those first four, anybody want to summarize those first four verses that we got through? Yes. He's, you know, just, yep. It doesn't change a whole lot. Obviously, you know, his mom didn't succeed in the disciplining of his attitude. You're fine.
Dad wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so he was throwing this feast or showing off his wealth to try to raise support and men for the conquest.
Yep.
Which I think ultimately fails.
Yes, it does ultimately fail. He works so hard to do that. And, you know, he's got such a vast kingdom. And, you know, I mean, we see here in these first few verses that, I mean, over and over again, it is establishing his authority. And yet he fails in this mass conquer of Greece. And, you know, his kingdom is constantly being thrown down at the bottom of his feet. And, I mean, truthfully, we even see that he fails in his own court, in his own palace. His own wife doesn't even submit to his authority. So, yeah, he's really got it all together. So we see that he's throwing this feast of 180 days to kind of gather all of the governors of the province to gather them for, to gather them to fight. And kind of this, He's trying to kind of gather their authority so that they will also want to fight with them, with him against Greece. So he's trying to show off his wealth and his splendor so that they can feel free to do that. So 180 days he takes to do that. They are feasting and getting highly drunk. Like we said, that word feasting, we can see from other texts that it most likely included eating and drinking, even though it doesn't explicitly say that here. It's very likely. The king, anywhere he went, pretty much was drinking, so it's pretty much assumed that that's what was going on. And then we see in the second feast that only lasted 7 days, it was taking place at the garden of the king's palace, which was a beautiful, beautiful garden, very luscious with green and lots of flowers. Persians loved their gardens, and so they were feasting in this garden for 7 days. And then we see, as we'll get into the text here, it's just incredibly, incredibly lavish. So, all right, yes.
The first feast that lasted the 180 days.
Yep. Well, so there's kind of all these different portions to that same area. So there's there's Susa, which is the city. And then there's a distinction between Susa, the city, and Susa, the citadel. And we even see that in Esther, that there's there's Susa, but it's kind of distinct. So Susa, the city, is like this outer line. And then Susa, the citadel, is one portion within that city. And then the palace would have been kind of in there. There's a French excavator that dug up this area. And he found what seemed to be four different mounds. One would have had the palace. I believe one would have had the citadel. Let me see. One had poorer homes that probably would have been the servants' homes, and then the other one had I don't know. Anyway, so there's kind of these different locations within the same, you know, spot. So
it was odd that you know, that verse 3 made a distinction and then verse 5 made a different distinction.
Sure. Sure. It's just really, truly kind of like here. I was going to show you guys some pictures of what the remains are that were found. And it covers kind of a large area. So that it's just kind of distinct, like even the palace here in the garden of the palace in verse 5, it says that the feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. It's just a section of the palace or of this whole citadel area. And then the other feast that lasted 180 days may have just been in a different portion of that.
In lots of
same. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. They're not all, you know, it's just kind of basically telling us that the feast isn't all happening in the same room. There was, I'll flip this around quick, but I believe this column yard, it was called the column of 100 columns or something, the room of 100 columns. It literally was a room that had 100 columns standing in it. Hold on, let me find this picture. You can see, let me see if I can make it bigger. I don't know if it's going to let me make it bigger. But you can see some of them still standing. I think this was back when this French excavator found it. So, you know, a while ago. I don't know what is still standing now. But those are just some of them. A lot of the columns have crumbled. So that was one portion of the palace. And then, I mean, let me see kind of an upward view. I was just so fascinated seeing the architecture that was still standing, you know, that's just amazing after all these years, you know. Oh, that was a statue with the head falling off. But also, it's a little wild to see it in this shape when you read here how extravagant it was. I don't know why it keeps flipping out. But anyway, so yeah, it would just be another portion of the same, you know, palace area, that there was another room. Because then we'll even see that Queen Vashti held her feast for the women in the palace that belonged to the women. There was another kind of like a room that I guess was her room that she held her feast there for the women. So all within Susa, but just different portion. What was that?
I got a commentary here thing right here. It says Susa, the winter resident was one of four city capitals, but the citadel refers to a fortified palace complex built above the city.
Right. Yep. So there was just kind of a mound. It was the Acropolis, you know, the palace sat on top of the Acropolis in the hill. So Susa was the main capital. There, like you said, like we talked about last week, there was several different capitals, but Susa is where King Darius, I believe, he made that kind of his permanent residence, so that he could. Just because it was very central and it was near a lot of lavish land, so it was just an ideal location to kind of set up your capital and reign from. But yeah, then they built the palace up on top of that hill there. So, yep. All right. And Terry, I know you had a question. Do you want to ask? You can go ahead now.
Completely off topic.
No, that's okay. That's right.
I listened to the first two. I was a little unclear. And then when I was reading the verses from Samuel, did the Amalekites get completely destroyed or not?
Back with Saul?
The only reason I question that is it said, obviously the directive was given, but then it said, they spared Agag the king, and then the best of the sheep, oxen, fatlings, and lambs, all that was good, not destroyed, and were not willing to destroy it utterly. But they didn't mention saving any men. They only, you know what I'm saying? It would appear, because then Samuel himself cut Agag to pieces. It would seem that all the Amalekites were destroyed at that time.
Well,
yep.
Yeah. I believe, I'm trying to see where I wrote it down in my notes, because I don't know if I'll be able to remember off the top of my head, but he had a son, King Agag did. And then that's where the line of the Amalekites kept going. I believe it was, I wish I could, let's see, right. I just wrote it down.
Somebody from his line survived.
Gotcha. Okay.
I just wrote down. Yep. I'm just looking real quick because I know I wrote down somewhere the son's name. Now I have to try and see. if it was here or if it was in chapter 2 that I wrote down the... I'll find it and I'll let you know, because there was a son that then continued on that line. Okay. Of the king that wasn't...
Mm-hmm. It says, you were not willing to destroy it utterly, but everything despised and worthless was destroyed. But mm-hmm. Does that mean any people were saved? That was my, like, it's so vague.
Yeah, and as far...
Specifically says, they did spare the sheep, oxen, and fatlings of lambs.
Yep.
But nothing about the people.
Well, I mean, here, hold on. Let me flip there. I might have to get back to it, and I'll look. Just because I remember, it's saying, why can't I see where that reference is? It's somewhere in 1 Samuel. Mm-hmm. Is that where... Were you reading from 15, Terry?
15:9, where they didn't destroy everything.
But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, of the oxen, and the fat, and the calves. All that was despised.
So they saved all that was good. Well, were any of the people good?
Sure. But verse 7 says, and Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword.
That's the one I read last week. Yeah, when I was first. I read that.
Sure.
After you had said that. Yep. Confused.
Yep. So, I mean, from there, I would say it seems that the only one that was spared was Agag. Now, can we be completely...
If you look at verse 33 of that chapter, Samuel calls them to bring Agag, and it says he hacked him to pieces before the Lord.
Right.
Right, from himself, he was, yeah.
So, somewhere along the lines, I guess Agag's son was spared. That
or
in...
Or hidden away or
if
something.
If you look mm-hmm. at 1 Chronicles 4, verse 43, this is a genealogy of Simeon. But it says at the bottom, and they defeated the remnant of the Amalekites. So this is going to be after Saul. This is in Chronicles. So
oh,
during the king
sure.
period.
Yeah.
So
there had to have been at least some.
Amalekites who had escaped, and they have lived there to this day. So there, I mean, even in Chronicles, you see the Amalekites again, that they're not all gone. Because it says 31, and these registered by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and destroyed the tents, settled in their place, and some of them, 500 men, you know, went to Mount Seir, and they defeated. So that's during the days of Hezekiah.
So is it possible that...
First Chronicles 4, 43.
43, okay, I was looking at 33. Okay, thank you. So, you know, here, they destroyed the Amalekites, perhaps in that location.
Right,
could have been
sure,
a
dispersed.
First Chronicles 4, 43.
Right. Right. Yeah. Did it say that the name of that son there in First Chronicles? I think that's where I was looking. Maybe. No. I'm pretty sure it is in First Chronicles because I know I have it written down somewhere, but I'll have to look and see. Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, it is because, I mean, if you were to leave your clan, just like we see the Israelites were really dispersed all over, it is possible that they were dispersed, and it was the Amalekites within the city that Saul
right.
slaughtered all of the ones that were there.
Right.
But
all Amalekites all over forever.
Sure, right. They are going to be, because God said that they were going to be blotted out. Their name was going to be blotted out. And that's why Saul... Or, well, that's where we see that Saul disobeyed, by keeping King Agag. All right. Well, sorry, that was a little bit jumbled of an answer. Okay. All right, any other questions before we move on? Okay. All right, so let's read. Why don't we go ahead and read verses 1 through... Hold on. Let me get back to Esther. Let's read verses 1 through 9, just so that we have it all together again. If somebody could read chapter 1 of Esther, verse 1 through 9.
Who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel of Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. The drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful, according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law, for there was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. Queen Vashti also held a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus.
Thank you. All right, so we've got that we believe that, like I said, the purpose of this feast was to gather the armies of Persia, of the Empire of Persia, so that they could go and battle against Greece. We see that he's showing off his greatness and his splendor to all of these officials to kind of, you know, pump himself up and make them feel like they're going to win. So verse 5 says, and when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting 7 days. So that first one that lasted 180 days, that was just for the officials of the nation. Now this one is for those great and small. So even the lowly of Persia were allowed to come and feast at this. Now that would have been pretty remarkable. I mean, for them to be able to come into the palace, just lowly peasants of Persia, that would have been really amazing for them to get to come and feast at the king's palace. But again, he's trying to show his dominance so that it emboldens the people of Persia to be able to go in and fight. All right. Verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. So this picture that we're getting is just, it's extravagant. I mean, gold couches, like, I mean, that's just incredible. Marble pillars. And like I said, I don't believe that this column of 100, this banquet of 100 columns would have been built quite yet at this time of Esther. But I want to show you just a little taste of, I'm going to show you this really short clip from the Khan Academy. And it talks about some of these pillars that were erected. And just, it's just so crazy. So let me pull this up really quick. Hopefully you guys can all see. Sorry, our... Oh, the sound's not playing. Okay. It was all queued up. Oh, here we go. It's just a couple minutes. But it just really shows the architecture. Can you guys hear that?
Egyptian or ancient Greek art.
And we're in a period when ancient Greece was in fact beginning to produce its most famous architecture. This is about 500 BCE. We're in the area that is currently Iran.
This is the Achaemenid Empire, and they ruled over a vast area of the Mediterranean and the Near East.
They tried to rule over ancient Greece, but the Greeks would be successful, much to their surprise. And just from this bull capital, because of its massiveness, and because you know that this is just one of dozens of such capitals, you get a sense of the scale of the royal architecture of this dynasty and the power of the Persians, and just how frightening that must have been to the ancient Greeks.
This capital was one of 36 that topped enormous columns in the audience hall, or Apadana.
So we're in the ancient city of Susa. This capital comes from one of two major palaces that were built by the Persian king Darius. Look at the size of those bulls.
Remember, he was the father of Xerxes.
So imagine this in a hypostyled or columned hall, this dense forest of columns, and this is where the king would receive visitors. So this expression of power within an entire palace complex built of precious materials brought from all over Darius's empire.
The large scrolling forms, which remind us a little bit of Ionic architecture from ancient Greece, would themselves have only been a transitional layer, because below that would have been an additional capital, and then below that would have been the shaft of the column itself with a base. The bulls themselves would have been quite high up and would have probably have been much more dimly lit than we're seeing them now. You can see how the two bulls are actually connected into a single form, with only the heads and the front parts of the bodies doubled. And then in the notch that is created in their backs, we have the beams of the palace cradled.
These capitals supported a very high wooden roof, probably 40, 50, or 60 feet high. They seem to be kneeling and yet towering above us. So I imagine anyone entering this hallway would have felt very small.
In part because you have this great mass that is at the very top of a slender column, which emphasizes that sense of scale. The other issue is that these are carved out of stone, which would have been imported from local mountains, whereas most of the palace was made out of mud brick that had been fired. And so the monumentality, the density of this stone would have been impressive as well.
One of the things you notice immediately when you look at the capital is that it seems to be comprised of two different colors of stone. And this is because what we're looking at is actually a composite restored by archaeologists from several different capitals.
Even though the bulls themselves are fragments that have been put together, some of the craftsmanship is still evident. Look, for instance, at the patterning of the curls of the fur. You can see that especially on the bull's breasts. The delicacy of the ears and the horns and the eyes. They really are expressive creatures.
But frightening. And everything in this palace was meant to impress. Some of the glazed brickwork survives from the palace. There are images of griffins, of sphinxes, of guards.
The guards are interesting. They're holding spears and they've got bows wrapped over their shoulders. You can actually see their quivers just over their backs.
This accumulation of images of power as you made your way up to the audience hall through this field of columns.
By the time you got your audience with the king, you would have been most impressed, and the power that he wielded over so much of the Mediterranean, over so much of the Near East, was clear.
So, I mean, seeing that and the massiveness of those bulls themselves, and then that they were up on top of a column, I mean, that is crazy. We have our own, you know, architectural technology that we have these giant, we have vehicles that can move those things, but they moved that by hand. I mean, those were stones that they carved and set up on top of these massive pillars. And so, like, as we see that everything had a purpose in showing authority and that dominance and that they were in control. And it was to intimidate you as you walked into the palace, that there's these massive, massive pillars. So there would have been, you know, some of these pillars at even, you know, at this time in this architecture. And so all these lowly, you know, people are now getting to feast with them, and they're going to come and see the grandeur of the palace and think, all right, we've got this, you know. But it was just amazing to me seeing that, that there are still bits of that left there, but it's showing that King Xerxes believes that he has all the glory and that he is truly the King of Kings. He believes that he's the King of Kings. So that decoration is just, it's just extravagant. We have here, the palace garden was a section of this palace, just one portion of it that would have been profuse with trees and shrubbery. I read the other day that lilac and tulip apparently are derived from a Persian word. And so tulip actually is derived, or, well, the word turban, like on your head turban, is derived from the Persian word tulip. Because, and I guess they were saying that when you look at a turban, it often looks kind of like the shape of a tulip when you see it wrapped around on their head. But it's because it's derived from that name. Persians loved their greenery. They loved the lavishness there. And right, like I said, right where they were, they did have their river that was running through there. And the area was very lavish with green. It wasn't just total desert like what you would see today. So it had the ability to grow and be just very, very beautiful place to be. The language that's used here in Esther is to overwhelm your senses at just the luxury and the magnificence of it. The marble could also read as alabaster in the Hebrew. It was likely taken from an Egyptian word to be able to formulate that word. The red feldspar, or the periphery, it was a hard rock that contained crystals. It was known for its durability, so that would have been why they used it as paving stones. Was that periphery? And then the mother of pearl may have been an Arabic pearl stone. Most scholars say that mother of pearl was not a suitable material because it just would, for at least for pavement or for a mosaic pavement, just because it was not very durable. So some believe that mother of pearl was a shell marble. It contained fossilized shells within it. And so then it gave that kind of marbleized look, like when you look underneath that, what are those big giant shells that, abalone shells that have that, you know, nice pearl color. So most likely that was the what was used for the mosaic pavements. So we just see here that it is incredibly, incredibly lavish. All right, so verse 7, drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. The point here we see is that these drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds. In history, there is a couple historians that mentioned that the Persians had great pride in having many different kinds of drinking cups. So they literally believe that each one of these could have been different, you know, like a different ornate vessel. They took great pride in those. Typically, you would drink out of a metal or glass type vessel. So the gold here, again, shows his wealth. Because if he's giving this feast for the whole of the nation of Persia, all of the people, low and the highest officials, and they each have their own cup. I mean, and their gold. So that's, you're talking thousands and thousands of, I mean, an immense amount of money just in the favor of a gold cup. So, well, one commentator made it sound like they were allowed to, like it was like their party favor they could take home. So, and there's nothing obviously that we see evidencing that, but he kind of thought maybe it was their party favor. You know, like we go to the wedding and we get the little like mints, and they go to Xerxes' party and come home with a gold cup. I would be taking a few, you know, when there's always the extra on the table, then I'd take a few of the extras that people left behind. But I mean, I can't even imagine all of them being different in how they look. It's kind of like our coffee cup collections. You know, we've got all the different, we can't just have one coffee cup because they always keep coming out with new cute ones. So the variety highlights, again, the magnificence of what Xerxes is trying to portray. Then we see that the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Now, we already see that the king loves his wine and he loves drinking. And so now he's going to say that now everybody can enjoy the same as what he does. And so it's lavish is a word to show us extravagance or abundance. And so he's saying, go ahead, go and drink. without restriction. In verse 8, it says, "And drinking was according to this edict. There was no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of this palace to do as each man desired." I find it really ironic that there had to be an issue decreed to drink as much as you want when that, like, it's just funny that there was no decree made yet to drink as much as you want. Like, I don't know. It's just funny that I'm probably butchering how I'm saying that, but literally the king, right. The one decree that's talked about is drink as much as you want. Like, there had to be a law about something that there is no law about. You know, I mean, in the sense of do whatever you want with it. It literally reads according to the king's hand. So drinking was according to this edict that there was no compulsion, for the king had given orders to the staff. So literally that can read in verse 7 and 8 that was according to the king's hand. So much.
That's interesting, because when I've read this in the past, I've always thought that meant if you don't want to drink, you
have to. Sure. It seems that he is implying you drink. Like, I'm making an edict that you drink, but it's without. I mean, now to say that there might be some who didn't drink, that it's possible, I guess. But it seemed it was very.
They used wine probably to purify their water.
Right.
So everyone drank.
Right.
To
right.
Some extent,
right. Right.
Because it was used, now, yes, very watered down.
Whatever. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. And I mean, this is lasting. The first one was 180 days. So over even a few days, I would think, even if it's tremendously watered down, you're going to start to feel something because that's all you're drinking incessantly. Right. And as much as you want. And we know humans, we know our nature. And when we are allowed to do something without compulsion, probably going to do it. You know, if you let a child have as much candy as they want, they're probably going to have as much candy as they want until they're sick.
Well, these are poor people.
Right.
This is their one
right.
opportunity in their entire life.
Yep. Yeah. To really party it up. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. No compulsion. According to the king. So, yeah. So it literally reads, according to the king's hand. So as much befits the king. It shows the lack of moral fiber that his law permits lawlessness for all. So, I mean, because if you're allowing everybody and anybody to drink as much as they want, clearly there's going to be order. No, there's not going to be any order because they're drunk. And we know that people make very poor choices when we're drunk. And so there's just, you know, King Xerxes is showing that it doesn't really matter to him the moral aspect of it, because there's just really going to be lawlessness once everybody starts drinking. Verse 8, according to the rule, you know, there was no restraint. This, it reflects, there was a custom in Persia that has been recorded by some of the historians that said that whenever the king drank, you drink when you were at a party. So you watch the king drink, then you would drink along with him. That was just kind of in honor of the king. Like, when you would bow down to the king, you would drink with the king whenever he drank.
Okay.
So interesting. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what?
So you gotta
eat fast. Yeah. Or hope she eats slow. And right. And I mean Queen Elizabeth, I'm sure, is very proper, and I'm sure she, you know, aren't you supposed to chew your food like 32 times each bite? I'm sure she does it. So obviously this is displaying a picture of most likely a drunken mob of people. All of these people, they're just drunk. They're drunk. And now the next verse is Queen Vashti. And we know, as the story goes on, if you've read Esther, that he wants to parade Esther in front of all these people, all these drunk people. Men. Yes,
and
men.
She has the women.
Yes. Yeah. So no wonder she said no. I would have said no too. Or I hope I would have. All right. Verse 9, we are introduced to Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. So the palace, like I said, it's got these different spots. And the queen, in tradition, women were not supposed to feast with the men in these famous, you know, in these big feastings. So it seems that maybe that's why Queen Vashti threw her own little party for the women of the area.
7 days as well.
It doesn't specify, but it's possible that it could be. No, yeah. Sure, right. Sure.
Both their
parties. Sure. It's possible that hers lasted for the whole time. I mean, I would think so, but there's nothing really that we have even outside of the text that would say specifically how long. But yeah, so just based on the architecture of the palace, probably she had this own little her own little court where the women would have been able to come and have their feast there, because they weren't to feast together. It was kind of a separation of that. The only time they came together was for sexual purposes, it seems. All right. So verse 10, let's go ahead and read. Let's read just verse 10 to verse 12. If somebody could read verse 10 through 12 for me.
On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgatha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him.
All right, so we see, even just in comparison, when Queen Vashti is mentioned, there is a stark contrast between her feast and King Ahasuerus' feast, because it goes on, you know, for several verses talking about King Xerxes' feast, and then Queen Vashti just says she had a feast. There's no details about the lavishness. It's just a simple feast. So, you know, we kind of see this as a meekness in contrast. King Ahasuerus is constantly being upheld as this magnificent king who has all of the authority of all the 127 provinces of the Persian Empire. And then Queen Vashti just is throwing this feast for this. It's just kind of almost like this side note, right? So then on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded all his, you know, his people, Memuham, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abgatha, Zethar, Carcass, and seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown. So the seventh day would have been the climax of the festival. You know, they've been feasting for 180 days. Now we get to the seventh day of the second feast, and this is the big shebang at the end. And they're all drunk with wine. It would be the height of drunkenness and debauchery. After, you can only imagine, after one day of heavy drinking, what would go on in someone's mind. Yeah, you'd think. You'd think they'd be passed out by day seven. Right, it's true. Right. Yeah.
Well, right.
Right. Yeah. I know. Yeah, it'd really be exhausting. I mean, 180 days of feasting would have been exhausting. When we throw one party, I'm ready for a nap afterward. but that was the tradition of the time. I mean, when you had a wedding, it was typically a week-long feast in preparation for the wedding. But so the seventh day is now this crowning, you know, day when they are all high in spirits with wine. And where it says there, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, it implies the heart of the king was good with wine. That's the literal explanation, that the heart of the king was good with wine. Now, we see in many other portions of scripture this same terminology used of the heart being good with wine. And one of them is in 1 Samuel 25. So let's turn there. First Samuel 25:36. Now, I'll just give you a little context for this, because this verse doesn't necessarily do that. But it's when David and it's with David and Abigail and King Nabal, right? Yeah.
He's not a king.
Not a king. Sorry. Yep. Yep. Oh, right. Where was I reading that? Maybe it's a different somewhere else that it was king. Right. That's true. That's true. Yes. He was like king. Yeah. So David wants to come and kill him. Abigail kind of talks David down from that to save him. So then in verse 36, it says, "And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of the king, of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry with him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." So, you know, Abigail was such a good wife to wait until he was a little less intoxicated, because she knows he's not going to make a good choice. If she had told him in the midst of his drunkenness, he would have gone raging mad, probably tried to go after David or something. But, you know, she was trying to be wise in that. So we can see that they're not very... Right, right. Ironic. But not great decisions are made when we're drunk. And Abigail had the wisdom to see that. 2 Samuel 13:28 is about Absalom. 13:28. Yep. Second Samuel 13:28. If somebody wants to read that for us. Valiant, yep. So here we see that Absalom is saying, wait until Amnon is merry with wine, until his heart is good with wine, because we know that he won't be able to make a choice to even save himself if he wanted to. And so we can see that clearly there is not a lot of good judgment when it comes to being drunk with wine or good, having a merry heart with wine, filled with wine. And King Xerxes is no exception. the Hebrew anthropology, the heart is the seat of the will and of thought. And we see that in scripture, that in Proverbs it says, guard your heart, for everything flows from it. So we know that what's in your heart is going to eventually flow out. And if alcohol is being consumed by your body, then most likely not good things are going to come from that. When the condition is brought on by alcohol, it implies an impaired judgment. So we see that the king is not able, he makes a lot of his choices when he's drunk, but a lot of them are not going to be well made. All right. The king's intoxication stated here continues to stress the frivolity and the excess of the event that had already been expressed. Okay, so then we see there's these people that King Xerxes commanded, these men, his officials that would really have been his right-hand men, and seven eunuchs. And we really want to pay attention to the eunuchs. Abner Chow said when I listened to his study on Esther, he said, pay attention to the eunuchs, because whenever they appear, usually either someone is saved or someone dies. And so typically it seems when the eunuchs appear with the Israelites, with God's chosen people, they seem to be saved. But whenever they appear with the pagans, it's typically on their way to execution, which will be interesting to appear.
You said the names of those people. Uh-huh. You said, and the seven
Mm-hmm.
Bible doesn't say and.
Or sorry, I shouldn't have said and.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I just assumed that those yep. are the names of the seven.
Yep. The yep, you're right. I shouldn't have said and. Yep. Sure. Uh-huh. Yep. Yep, I must have slipped an and in there. So these seven eunuchs were there. You know, and it's also interesting that did they really need seven eunuchs to go and fetch the queen? I mean, it seems a little bit like overly done. Again, just showing this excessiveness of the king.
When it's odd, when so many people are not named,
mm-hmm.
to actually give sure. the names of these guys.
Right.
It's unusual too.
Right, it's true.
Well, and that probably is what Abner picks up on is whenever God names someone, it's important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even if it's, you know,
right.
we would just fly right on past.
Right, it, right, right. Yep. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And I wonder if the fact that he sent seven of them speaks to their relationship before this all started, because if he knew she was going to obey him like she would normally,
sure.
he would just send somebody to give her a message and she'd show up.
Sure.
You know, maybe.
Yeah,
things haven't been going
well. Sure.
I want her to come. I'm going to send
sure. It could be. Yeah, I don't know. Commentators didn't make any distinction that way, but it's possible that she maybe was defiant in the past. I don't know. Yeah. All right. Let's see, where am I? All right. It does kind of give a tone, though, of somewhat of a mockery of where he's sending all of these officials, and we know that she's just gonna disobey, and so it's just interesting that yet you have this king who is so powerful in his own mind and so authoritative, and he sends his officials that are supposed to carry out his word, and yet she obeys. So it kind of mocks, in a sense, his command. What follows, he can't even control or bend his own wife to his will. Yet he thinks he can control an entire nation, an entire 127 provinces, but yet his own wife, he can't even make her submit to his will. All right, and then verse 11, where it says, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty. It is very much believed by commentators across the board that it was insinuating just in her royal crown, wearing nothing else. She was to come parading out in just her royal crown.
Can you blame her for saying that?
I know, in front of all these drunks. The word for that royal crown in Hebrew is only used here in Esther. We'll see it again a little later in Esther. They use that same terminology as the headdress for the horses that would drive his chariot. The same word that they use for this royal crown is also used a little bit later in Esther for the headdress of a horse. So basically it's just some sort of, they believe it to be more of like a turban that had jewels that were inset. I wanted to see if I could find a picture, but I couldn't find anything that looked or that was trying to represent this, but they believed it was more of a turban that had jewels inset to it. As opposed to like what we think of as a crown, you know, a gold crown with jewels.
Did you read anything? Because I think I've heard in the past they also think at this time she was pregnant.
Oh, I didn't.
With Artaxerxes.
Yeah. And it could, right, it could be.
I mean,
right.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Huh.
I mean, I haven't really studied it.
I wonder, just because with her being naked, if she was naked and only wearing a dress, and it, I mean, I guess depending on how far along she was in the pregnancy, but I don't know.
Now,
it's interesting.
In your studies, did you find that they actually killed Vashti, or she was just put away?
I didn't find anywhere that they killed her. She was just disposed as being the queen. Yeah.
Because if she was pregnant with Artaxerxes is the one that
follows. Right.
Yeah.
Couldn't have killed her.
Right.
Have you seen somewhere, read
no,
somewhere? Or you just were wondering? Okay,
wondering.
Okay. As far as I see, nothing says that she was killed, but just taken him from her spot as queen. Yep. Oh. Interesting.
Because
Artaxerxes came next after Xerxes as king.
Yeah,
interesting.
So were you saying after Xerxes dies and Artaxerxes becomes king, then
maybe she comes?
The king mother has power.
Mm-hmm. And
it just says apparently after Esther's death or her fall from favor, Vashti was able to reassert her power and to exercise a controlling influence over her son.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, so she's kind of the puppet behind, or the puppet master behind the string, you know, working. I mean, and Xerxes
wouldn't have true power until the dad is dead.
Right, right. And Xerxes only was there until 46. Yeah. All right. So there's Jewish tradition that says possibly part of the reason why King Xerxes wanted to parade his wife around in front of everybody is because him and all the other officials of the nations were having a disagreement as to who had the most beautiful woman. And so he decided he was going to show them he did, that he had the most beautiful woman.
This is Jewish tradition
says that this was the conversation happening right up to her, him wanting her to come out. So yeah, they were drunk and arguing over who had the most beautiful woman or the most beautiful wife. And Xerxes obviously wants to declare that his is the most beautiful. And so he beckons his wife to come out. He decides to settle the argument.
You think about like what you were telling us before about uh-huh. where he's displaying his royal glory.
Right. And so yet again. Right. Right. Yep. He wants to settle the argument that even his wife, he has the most beautiful. And we again see that shot down. And even in Persian culture, I read that it was against Persian culture to for women to be appearing in public. That wasn't, you know, I mean, in that time, women were lesser. And so that even is more to this tradition of him bringing her out. It kind of illumines a
culture.
Right. It even goes against culture. So, you know, he's making this this statement that he wants to show his power. And so he's willing to even go against the culture and do that. And I mean, they're all drunk and oftentimes you make poor judgment when it comes to women when you are drunk. And so he's deciding to just say, oh, I'm going to show off, you know, my woman, even in spite of what the culture was at that time,
so
to not parade women. Sure. Moral
customs of the time, but then she gets
right. Right. Disposed. Yeah.
Even though
yeah.
what she was being asked was
right.
wrong in society's eyes.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Ahasuerus, he was treating her like a trophy wife. And again, like we've seen before, the decrees of the, Medes and the Persians were not to be revoked once they were into decree. So she was really going in against this decree by saying no, because you weren't supposed to disobey it. It was supposed to follow through. But Queen Vashti, let's read. Or no, we already read that. But verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. So she refuses. She refuses, even though the king is this big, hot guy that everybody looks up to, and he's got all the glory and all the riches, the wealth to be able to give everybody a golden cup. and yet she refuses, even at his authority. And truly, we don't really know the reason why she refused. Could it have been just because of the culture at that time? Or could it have truly been because she doesn't want to parade herself around naked in front of a bunch of drunk men? Who knows? Either one of those would have been great reasons to not. Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to do that either. There's no way I would have wanted to. It's an embarrassment. I mean, that's an awful thing to ask of your wife, to parade around in front of a bunch of people when they're drunk, regardless of if they're drunk or not. It's an awful thing to parade. So, I mean, we don't see a lot of Vashti in the story of Esther, but her role is very significant to the story of Esther, because she had to be disposed in order for Esther to take place, her place. So truly her place in this story is, it's vital for her to have said no, because that was the reason that she was disposed. And like we talked about before, in God's providence, he is using each one of these little parts, the little piece of the men becoming drunk so that King Xerxes calls out his wife, so that she says no, so that she's disposed, and so that there's a place for Esther. And God, in his providence, is seen to his will. He's seen to make it happen. And he's using each one of these little elements to do that. In her saying no, that was an incredibly important element to move the story along. God is hidden, but he is active in this story. He is using each one of these pieces to bring his will about. Her refusal gets her dethroned. And in contrast, she's replaced with Esther, who, as we go through and see the beginnings of Esther, she seems to be pretty passive in the beginning, in the sense that she goes to the harem. There's no record of her fighting the decree to be brought to the harem. So she seems pretty passive there. She doesn't say anything when they try to stuff her with all the food that they want to feed her. So it does seem to be some contrast in the sense of Vashti adamantly refuses, and Esther is kind of a little bit more passive in her place in the beginning. Now, obviously, we know the end of the story, and Esther does end up standing up to the king, but Vashti seems to have this very immediate defiance to the king, and Esther, almost, I get this feeling as you read the text that she's like sweet talking him, because she throws this feast for him and, you know, makes him happy with the food and, you know, all these things. So she's kind of like trying to sugarcoat what she wants to say to get him in a happy mood, whereas Vashti's just like, nope, not coming. So Esther, who she will have to come boldly before. Now, again, if we remember back to in the intro where I shared with you those stories of what Xerxes did to the people who crossed him, he just slaughtered them. I mean, this is the king who he could have easily killed off Queen Vashti. Must have loved her at least a little bit to just say.
Was pregnant.
Yeah, maybe. Right. Maybe. Maybe.
Son,
sure.
Know.
Right.
Yeah, right. Saved her life.
Right. Because it seems like in history, he just
right.
slaughtered anybody who crossed his path. If you so much as walked in front of his little chariot as he was out talking with the soldiers, he beheaded you right there. If you walked behind him, he beheaded you. You weren't allowed to come within a certain radius of his chariot or he'd behead you. He, remember that friend of his that he was visiting, and he cut the son in half because he simply asked to keep him from war. And so this is the king who Vashti is saying no to, and this is the king that is before Esther. He was a hothead and would get rid of you in an instant, no problem. It was no sweat off his back.
Well, and Esther never took any initiative until she was strongly mm-hmm. encouraged by Mordecai.
Right, right,
yeah,
yep.
And he kind of mm-hmm. holds her into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, this also would have been an honor-based society. And in an honor-based society, you do whatever it takes to honor the person in authority, whether it's a child to their parent or you to an authority at that time. I mean, we see even today, the amount of sex trafficking that goes on around the world in third world countries where, I mean, in, is it Cambodia or Cambodia, I think. I was just listening to a guy the other day talk. They're trying to rescue girls out of sex trafficking there. And they have an honor-based society to where they were able to get in and meet with these girls, and they told them, they said, we will rescue you out of this. We can get you out. We'll give you the money, whatever you need to get out. And they said, well, I have to talk to my mom, because their moms are the ones who are allowing them to go into the sex trafficking in this culture, which is so mind-blowing to us, but that is their mode of financial ability. So he's like, okay, we'll go talk to your mom. They go and talk to their mom, and the moms refused. They wouldn't let them because that's their source of income. Is selling their daughters into slavery. And so then the girls, they said, no, we can't. We have to honor our parents. And so they would continue to go back. And so this, too, is an honor-based society where you, even for Vashti, I mean, that was a huge deal for her to say no to the king. That was a huge deal to dishonor him in that way. I mean, the embarrassment that he must have felt before all of the provinces and all the elected officials, oh, that would have been so embarrassing.
That's why his wrath burned with
yes.
him.
Right. They
loss of face.
Yeah.
That's a big thing in Asia. Loss
right.
of face.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's huge. It's yeah, huge. So in an honor-based society, shame constitutes a grave offense which regularly produces the most extreme responses. So we see he gets real angry. Really angry, because not only is she denying what he wants, but also it is in front of the officials and the people of all 127 provinces of the kingdom that he rules over. And it doesn't help that he's trying to gather these people to go up to war against the Greeks, and now his own wife just said no to him. So that it's not proving his power or ability to have an ability to attack the Greeks and be successful if his own wife can say no and his plans be thwarted. So I would say that his anger probably was contributed to that fact because of him trying to gather them for the war against Greece. All right, so then let's read verse 13 all the way to 22. Somebody could read that.
The wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king so to speak before all who knew law and justice. And were close to him, Kershina, Shethra, Shethar, Edmatha, Karshish, Neres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. And in the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying King Ahasuerus commanded King Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. For this day the ladies of Persia and this day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti should come no more into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. And when the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. And this word pleased the king and the princes, and the king gave it many times proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, that every man should be the master of his own house, and the one who speaks in his own language of his own people.
Thank you. All right, so verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all those who were versed in the law and judgment. So these would have been the men closest in contact with him that knew the laws, knew it was just his legal counsel, basically. and we will see oftentimes throughout here, the king does not make a lot of his decisions on his own. He seems to, get the counsel of his advisors, which maybe is wise, especially considering he's probably drunk out of his mind. But at the same time, who should we be getting counsel from? Does he go to the Lord for counsel? No, he doesn't. He goes to these men who are beside him to find counsel. And they clearly know what's best. Let's legislate the honoring of our husbands by in this. We'll see, later that they basically make it a decree that wives are to honor their husbands. There's three of these men are identifiable in the Elamite genealogy, which Queen Vashti is believed to be of the Elamite genealogy. And three of these men, Merez, Marcina, and Memucan, are found elsewhere in other extra-biblical areas that we see their names come up. All right, so then verse 15, he says, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? So he's saying, what are we going to do with her? What are we going to do with this defiant queen that I have? And he wants to know legally what will happen, what we should do with them. Apparently the king couldn't even handle the affairs of his own wife, just, between him and his wife. He had to get the counsel of these other legal men. Sure. Right, concerning my wife. Oh man, it's just crazy. So Memucan is kind of the ringleader of the group of the eunuchs. He takes the lead and he says, then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. So Memucan seems that you wonder, is it his own personal interest that he's giving this advice, or is it truly at the interest of the king? Is he trying, could he be trying to protect the embarrassment of the king by taking the spotlight off of him and saying, all right, we have to abolish what Queen Vashti did across the board? Or maybe it's for his own personal interest because, he doesn't want his wife getting news of this and then going and dishonoring him all the time. Who knows? But it seems that he's placing this decree on the action of what Queen Vashti did. None of it has to do with what predicated her action. None of it has to do with not asking your wives to parade around in front of drunk men. It has entirely everything to do with her just being dishonoring, as opposed to what the king's part was in it.
Was part of it just God using this to his own advantage?
Sure. I think that in God's providence, every single piece of this, it is him using and purposing it towards his will. I mean, what would happen to all these husbands in the nation as they come to find that she said no? Now they're afraid that all the wives are going to get word and start saying no as well to them, and they couldn't have that. That there's just no way. So we've got to make a decree against it. Regardless, of what his concern was, the husbands were just, they were fearful that they were going to be despised by their wives. And I mean, we see this even now. We cannot legislate the heart. And so they're putting a decree into place. Now, who's going to enforce that, for one? I mean, I suppose the husbands could enforce it if their wives, but how can you legislate the heart? Because the heart is eternally sinful, and it's sinful from conception. And so it's very difficult when you're dealing with your husband every single day. How we know, I think we could say firsthand that it is very difficult sometimes to be respectful as God has called us to. And so now the husbands are all thinking, oh, great. Now we've got a little loophole to where we're going to make a decree so that you have to or else. And it doesn't say what the or else is, but I don't know how they were going to enforce those things or what they would have done to punish them. But you better listen or else, you know, here's Queen Vashti, the example that she was disposed as queen. All right, so the decree was made to make an example of Vashti. And again, the decree cannot be revoked when it comes to the king. So who knows? I don't know how they were going to try to enforce this. But all right, so we'll go into verse 17. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. So we see that the decree was made that she just was to be out of his sight. It not necessarily that she was killed, but that she was no longer to be in this place of queen.
What don't it sound like she may not even have been moved out of the palace?
Possible. It's possible. But yeah, because there was such a vast array of rooms in the palace that, I mean, I guess she could have still.
As long as she doesn't see the king.
Yeah, it's possible.
Which, you know, Esther went for a long time without seeing the king.
Right, a year.
She was afraid to.
Right, or more.
Him, so
right.
It wasn't abnormal.
Right.
She regulated to the harem, I would say. Like.
Sure, right.
Or the king probably never
right.
went. He just summoned
right.
whoever.
Right, right. They came it. To. Right. Right. Yep. For sure. So this decree would have, remember we were talking about that royal road that went from Susa all the way to, I forget where it lands, but it's this royal road that King Darius, he had created this postal service system to disperse all the decrees. So they would have taken that decree. I thought it was so interesting. So our postal system today, really kind of the phraseology that is used in the postal service was taken from here, from where King Darius made this postal system. So it says it would have been distributed on the royal road. King Darius said, neither snow nor rain nor gloom of night stay these valiant carriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. So that's the U.S. Postal Service's motto, and they got it from him. I thought that was so crazy. Yeah, we stole it from King Darius. What's that? King Darius had said it at some point. So I just read it in a... No. Yeah, yes. I think they found it inscribed on a piece of things that they've excavated. Yeah, they found it inscribed. There's several things that they have found that King Darius inscribed on... Well, he probably didn't inscribe it, but he said it, and someone else inscribed it. But yeah, I thought that was so cool or interesting. So Herodias, the historian who wrote a lot about Persia, he said, it is said that there are as many horses and men posted at intervals along the road as there are days required for the entire journey. So one horseman and one man are assigned to each day, and neither snow or rain nor heat or dark of night keeps them from completing their appointed courses as swiftly as possible. So they would have passed it on each day. They would arrive at the next one and keep going, just like how we did, until it reached all of the surrounding areas. It says that royal road would have taken about 7 to 9 days by horse and about 3 months on foot. So they just would have passed it on. So the decree would have gone out within at least a week and a half time to the whole. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Yep. So, you know, Memucan here, we see that he's kind of capitalizing on Xerxes' desire to be the greatest of the great and to have all of the honor. And so he's going to benefit his own household from this decree by his wife having to follow it. Right? Maybe. Maybe that's some of the instinct. So the decree would have been universal distribution. No excuse would have been permitted for not understanding it. So it's said they have found this decree in several languages. And so
this specific one about submitting to your
yes. Kingdom? Well, okay. Here, let me see. Let me just make sure. It may not have been this specific decree, but in that time, they have found decrees to be in several different languages. So like even where when King Darius built the palace, there the talking about what was to be brought from all of the different nations to build it and erect it, it was found in many, many different languages so that they knew. And every time, there are several different decrees that were found. So I shouldn't say this specific one, but many have been found.
There is no excuse.
Right.
The decree is
right.
In your native tongue.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. I mean, maybe they would have added that in there because they want to let the women know what in terms of this is your example that Queen Vashti was disposed. Nothing specifically states what is going to happen to the women. Like, it doesn't say you're going to be divorced if you know, whatever. But I would assume they probably would have added that into the decree so that the women would have been fearful then of what could happen to them if they were to disobey it. But the decree itself is just that you are not to dishonor your husband.
Well, actually, I mean, it says every man should be the master of his house. I guess we just don't know what the
Right.
The thing is, every man is already the master.
Right,
of his
I know, exactly.
I mean,
and so now they're trying to legislate.
But women didn't have a ton of power to begin with.
Right, right. Right.
Now mine says, yours is that verse 20?
22.
In 20 it says all women will give honor to their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're hoping,
that
seems, 20 seems to indicate that they're hoping that that would be the desired effect of the edict. When the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard, then all women will give honor to their husbands.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, yep.
Yeah. And I think it would be. I mean, even in a culture like Macia said,
right.
Men are in charge.
Right.
You know, to send out this saying, look, even the queen disobeyed
right.
and she was done.
Right.
Deposed
yep.
whatever, you know.
Right.
Try it.
Right. Yeah.
Warning.
Right. Yeah.
These men must have not been very confident in their wives.
Right. And I mean, we see from Proverbs that it's better to live, it's better to have a dripping on the roof than a quarrelsome wife, or I'm probably butchering that. But so, I mean, And so, obviously, the women, and we know ourselves, you know, and I don't think we've changed a whole lot since since this time. It's hard sometimes, and it's very hard. And we want to honor the Lord by respecting and honoring our husbands. But legislating it is probably not going to bring about a whole lot of change other than you're threatening them. And so therefore kind of the structure of their relationship. Mm-hmm.
Miserable even
right.
While
yep.
Or
right.
Or
right.
Whatever.
Right. All right. So, verse 20. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all of his kingdom, for it is vast. All women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, so that would have been on the royal road in what we just talked about, to every people in its own language. So this, again, it was written in their own language so that there was no discrepancies about it. That every man be made master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. So kind of in the end of 22, it addresses this issue of the Jews' language was no longer prevalent in Jewish men's household. Now, because remember, they've been dispersed, or these ones who are dispersed, they've been assimilated to the culture, so they've probably assimilated to the language as well. They may still have spoken some of their Jewish language, but probably they have added on the language of wherever they were in dispersed in the Persian Empire. So there was several different languages that we know of at this time. So, you know, in just kind of summary of chapter one, we see how easy it can be to be assimilated to the culture. And I think that sometimes you just have to laugh at the empire at hand that is trying to assimilate you, because even he couldn't even force the will of his own wife, and he thinks he's so powerful. It also just shows us that we see what God's doing. Even though he's not visible here, he is using this story of these very pagan people and this man Xerxes, who believes that he's the King of Kings. God even uses him in the story of furthering his people and in saving his people. So it's just amazing to see that even though we see God nowhere in here, he's not stated here, he's not even prayed to, and yet we can see his hand working behind the scenes in all of these things to end up saving his people and protecting his people. We also can see that even though this kingdom at the time was so lavish and so ornately decorated and made to look so beautiful, it has nothing in comparison to the kingdom of God. And I just, you know, if this was described so eloquently, I can only imagine what heaven will be like one day. It's, yes, right, not just couches or cups. So, you know, we're going to constantly see a contrast of this kingdom of King Xerxes in contrast. We can contrast it with the kingdom of God, and how, I mean, we saw those pictures. It's ruined. It's devastated. It was not long after Xerxes reigned that it was destroyed under Alexander the Great. It was totally annihilated. It was burned. And so he thinks he's got it all together here. He thinks that he is ruler of all and King of Kings. And we are going to see that is not the case. We know that it's not the case because we know the end of the story. So, all right. Any questions before we end? I'm sorry. I felt a little bit jumbled today, so I'm sorry if it seemed a little all over the place. But any questions or comments before we go? All right. I will close this in prayer. Lord, we are just so grateful for your word. We are grateful to get to study it. And we are so grateful that you are the one true King of Kings, that you have nothing on King Xerxes. Lord, I can only imagine at the time that Xerxes was reigning, the people who were being submissive to him and how fearful they probably were of his power. But we have nothing to fear in you, Lord. We get to surrender to you, the true King of Kings. And I'm so grateful for that hope that we have in you, knowing that you have the rule in the end. So I pray that we continue to have open hearts and minds to hear what you have to say to us, and that we would continue to learn from this story of Esther. We know that you placed it in your word for a special reason. And I pray that we would just relish in how incredible you are, that in your providence you work even through these awful people, but that you work your will out through all of it. So we know that if you can even use them, that you can use us. And I pray that we would take that truth into our lives, that we would continue to strive towards righteousness and goodness and holiness. So I just pray all these things in your name. Amen.